You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com. Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story as we pull the best interviews from the archives of the IFH Podcast Network. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind. This episode originally aired on the Indie Film Academy podcast.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T, chart. I'd like to welcome to the show Jen Grisanti. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. You are a very, very busy lady and doing lots and lots of good work for a lot of screenwriters out there. So thanks for taking the time out to talk to the tribe.
It is my pleasure. Thank you.
So how did you get into this crazy business?
You know, I went to USC and I studied cinema and communications.
Never heard of it.
And, I got out of school. I really didn't have anybody contact-wise. I knew I wanted entertainment. I didn't know exactly what capacity. So I went to Friedman, a job finding agency, which is focused on entertainment jobs. And that helped me build my resume. I also, which is great for people to know, like just did cold calling and called all my top places that I wanted to work. And I said, I'm willing to intern. Mm-hmm. And that helped me build my resume. And then
Real quick, is that something that you think that is doable even in today's world with so much more competition?
I definitely do. I mean, I talk to so many people who do cold calling, and it's first of all, when you're offering to work for free as an intern, that certainly has its leverage with
sure.
it. You know, it's just, can you afford to do that? I recommend, like, what I didn't know, and of course I was in college at a whole different time than now, but what I didn't know is, like, I should have started during college doing all my internships.
That's what I did. Yeah.
See, that's the smart way to go. And so, I definitely believe in the cold calling is a good way. And then the great thing is when you do apply to an agency like the Friedman Agency or the Comar Agency in Beverly Hills, then you have a resume already started. So you're not like going into these companies with nothing on your resume. And then you get placed. I got placed in the Spelling office. So, you know, through Friedman, and that changed my entire career. I mean, you know, that was a pivotal moment in the deciding of what direction I was going to go with my career.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the Spelling office. And when you say Spelling office, you're talking about the legendary Aaron Spelling. For audience members who don't know who Aaron Spelling is, please tell a little bit about who he is and what he did, and then what was it like being mentored by a giant like that?
Of course. So, well, Aaron Spelling, if you I'm like the younger audience doesn't have near as much knowledge. And I totally understand and appreciate that. CW has done a new 90210 and a new Melrose Place. But Aaron Spelling was the originator of like Dynasty, TJ Hooker, and a million shows. Like he is one of the most prolific producers in history with the number of hours of television that he produced. And then when I started in his office, 90210 had been going for a year. Like there was a point in Aaron's career that that they called ABC because he had seven shows on ABC. They called it Aaron's Broadcasting Company. And so, and that didn't go over too well. So that, you know, so he went through that era and then all of his shows got canceled at a similar time that were happening at that time. And then he kind of went through a dry spell before 90210, which really, so when I entered his office, he was in such a place of, he was so humble and so open because of what he had experienced. And 90210 was taking off at the time that I was in the office.
Yeah,
it was the first year. And then Melrose Place was, the day that I started, Melrose Place was being cast. So the original Melrose Place and the original Beverly Hills 90210. So that was, you know, then Spelling was on fire again. And then everybody wanted to be in business with him. And he did a lot of business with Fox, obviously, because of 90210 and Melrose Place, and then branched out into CBS and other network and NBC. And it really, things took off again. So it was a very good time. I was 24, he was 69. So it was a very good time because he was in a life place where he wanted to mentor. And he really wanted to teach me how to be his eyes and ears for, you know, for scripts and story coming in. So I was very blessed. You know,
you were at the right place at the right time.
I was. Yep. It was a good thing.
and for people listening, I mean, you can't underestimate the power of what 90210 did and Melrose Place did at the time. It was a phenomenon. It really was. I actually lived down the street in Florida in that mall where Luke Perry created the riot.
Oh, I love that. That's great. I love that. I mean, it was a pivotal time in my life. And even though, like, I had graduated college when it was first started, it was still such a pivotal time because high school is such a time for every single one of us. It's such a growth period that we we're going through like a huge arc of growth. And so looking at them kind of go through their joys and their trials and their tribulations, it brings us back into it. You know,
but they were all 27 at least.
Yes, exactly. I know. They were a little outside.
There was nobody who was a teenager.
There was some creative liberty. There was no doubt about that.
I mean, Luke Perry, I think, was like 30. Honestly, he was like 30
Isn't
years
that
old.
Funny. I know, that's so funny. I remember all that went with that choice. Yes. I love Luke. Luke is such a good guy.
Now, what did you? What were some of the biggest takeaways you got from Aaron?
You know, I mean, again, it was a gift to be taught by a gentleman who was so about the work and so passionate about the work. And so, like, he expected a lot from you in that he expected, you know, he expected perfection, and that was a very hard thing to learn to really operate on that level, but it was the greatest training ground. And because he expected perfection from himself and he gave it, it really helped you to look at things and really operate at a high level. Now, it's not to say, like, when I say the word perfection, you are going to make mistakes along the way in every path.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And it really, I think what he taught me was, you know, if a mistake is made, then it's how you fix it that makes the difference. It's how you respond after it, how you take responsibility for it, how you move forward after it. He was a master when it came to story. So watching him in the, we would have rough cuts in his office of the episodes, and a rough cut is after production is done and it comes into the producer's office. And then you watch what's called rough cut. And it was always really amazing to see how you could take a script and do all your notes on the script. And then when it would be filmed, then recognize, well, there are changes that I want to make. And through editing, like just watching how he would do things to like make the act break more impactful, or how he would move around scenes so that the story would work in a lot stronger way. And really, you know, learning about, I think the thing that made him the happiest was, you know, knowing that he had the ability to discover young talent. And by young, I don't mean age. I just mean young at the beginning of the career. Mm-hmm. So he to discover newer talent and know that he could open a door that could change someone's life.
Now, how long were you with Aaron Spelling?
12 years.
Wow. So you were there for a while.
Yes.
I'm assuming you rose in the ranks.
I did. And again, it's always good for people to hear, like it's really focusing on what you want. I was lucky that at the time I was in his office, my mom had given me tapes from Tony Robbins, and that tape set had really helped me hone in on what do I want and how do I get there? And what are the action steps that I need to take? So when I was in his office, I recognized there was no one reading scripts in his inner office, in his immediate office. So because he would always do like 5 or 10 calls trying to find the answers to things, I thought, well, why don't I just read the scripts? And of course, that meant that I worked till 8:30 at night and read scripts till 11:30 at night, but it was worth it. And so that is what began the process of me reading scripts. And then we go over the script the following day. And that's really what taught me. And then from there, I became a coordinator of current programming, then a manager, then a director. And then I ran current programming at his company for my last 2.5 years before I was promoted to CBS Paramount, where I was vice president of current programming.
And were you there during the Charmed years?
I was. Yes.
I used to love that show.
Yes. Charmed was a blast. It was amazing with that show to see where it started and see where it went as well. I think that was the most rewarding part of current programming was, you know, really watching a show develop and find its voice and find its audience within the time. And certainly we're in a day and age where the TV shows don't have the luxury now that they did when I started my career, in that now they really, you know, ideally a current show usually can take anywhere from 5 to 8 episodes to really find its voice and to really blend the network, the studio, and the showrunner's vision into something that really works. And now the hard thing is very often you don't have that kind of time. So you have to find what the show is sooner.
Right, because it's just too much before there was
too
three
much
channels.
Competition.
There was three channels, and you could just sit. You could either watch what we're putting out, or you can watch nothing. It's
exactly.
There was three shows on at 9 o'clock.
I know. I mean, when I started my career, the only specs people were writing were Sopranos and Sex and the City. You know what I mean? So it was like, you know, how fascinating how different things are now.
Very much so. Well, can we talk a little bit about the explosion in scripted series and the opportunities for writers today? I mean, isn't there like 450 script this year.
You know, it's fascinating. Like, even though there's massive opportunity in television, and there definitely is, it doesn't make the path to getting a job that much easier. I wish that it did.
Yeah, right. Like the doors would be open. No, but the thing is, there's just more competition now.
There is.
If there would have been 450 shows in 1990, then yes, anybody who could literally just get up to a typewriter
And write a script,
type something like a monkey, could get a job.
Yeah.
But there's so much more.
No, it's not the case. I mean, it really takes a village to get a person staffed. Like, when I was starting as an executive, you know, really, I mean, I really worked hard on staffing most of the shows that I worked on. I worked with my executive producer, and I was in all the meetings with the writers, and I handled many of the calls with the agents. Mm-hmm. So you really saw, you know, what went into why the people were getting staffed were getting staffed. And so it was, and it shows you. And I definitely think, and trust me, in my business, Jen Grisanti Consultancy Inc., I've been doing this for 10 years. And I look at how many feature writers I've worked with that I've gotten to write television. And just because there definitely is more opportunity in TV. So if the talent is there, in my opinion, the platform to be in is television right now.
That's what everyone I've been talking to says the exact same. Well, there's it's a renaissance, honestly. Yes. It really is. And it started with the Sopranos. Would you argue it started with the Sopranos, honestly?
Yeah, I would totally agree.
Yeah. And it kind of just went from there. Could Breaking Bad have happened in the 90s?
I know. I mean, you do look at the pivotal shows, and the fascinating thing now, like when you look at shows now, like the OA and Sense8 and Fleabag, and there's a great show on Netflix called DePoursant, 10%, or Call My Agent is the English title. Mm-hmm. And that it's brilliant. And so, you know, I think the work being done right now, a lot of the shows that I teach from currently, I can't tell you, like so many of the shows that I teach from are British shows too, you know, that land on Netflix, or Amazon or Hulu. And they get to go outside the box. They have more freedom. And because they have more freedom and more creative liberty, I find that I'm able to create story tools from the writing on there that I'm able to pass on to the writer so that they can write the script that can't be ignored, that will lead to a sale, that will lead to them getting staff.
And do you suggest that writers do a screenplay or a teleplay first? Which one do you think, if you're a screenwriter and you want to get attention, do you write a teleplay first or do you write a feature screenplay first as a proof, not proof of concept?
I mean, you can, certainly, like when you're looking at writing portfolio right now, you could have a feature script in it. Now, you're never going to get someone in television to read a feature script unless they hear it so good and the content in it is so right for the show that is being staffed. Mm-hmm. So really in TV, you want to write. Now, of course, what you're asking, I think, as well, is do you write a spec script of a show that's already on or do you write an original? And, you know, there are different schools of thought. Certainly when I came up the ranks, you had to have two spec scripts in your writing portfolio that were current, no older than 2 years old, and two originals. And I would definitely say there's been a shift and that there are writers out there who really don't want to write TV spec scripts of existing shows. They only want to write original material. It used to be that you had to have it. And the reason was, because when you would try to, you know, when I would pitch a writer to my executive producer with a TV pilot, they would read the pilot first and be, you know, and really want to know the original voice of the writer. But then they'd ask for the spec script because they wanted to know that that writer knew how to mimic somebody else's voice.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. Right. And that's a really good point when you're writing for a show, because a lot of writers have a very unique voice. Yes. You know, Tarantino has arguably one of the most unique voices out there.
Yes.
And he did do some writing. He did a CSI episode, which
right.
and an ER episode, actually.
I love it. That's great. I didn't know that.
And he wrote them in
right.
Tarantino. But he was Tarantino, so they let him kind of go off a little bit.
Right.
But generally speaking, when a writer comes on staff, he has to mimic the show. He can't be himself or herself.
Yes.
What kind of tips do you have for writers to be able to adapt like that?
Well, you have to know, I think also now more than ever, you have to understand your voice. And I always ask writers, do you know what your voice is? And then I'll get like, say, a third of a room that knows. And then I'll say, how would you describe it? And then I'll have like maybe four hands left that really know how to describe their voice. And mm-hmm. so I think part of the journey for the writer is knowing what your voice is. And then when you're mimicking somebody else's show, I've had many writers say, well, I can't really use my voice on someone else's show because it's their show. Now that mm-hmm. that's not true, because I remember Dan O'Shannon, who's an Emmy Award winning writer from Modern Family. He said to me, like, one of his strategies, and I loved it, of when he was staffing for shows at the beginning of his career, was he would find out the character that they struggled the most with writing wise. Mm-hmm. And he would have a pitch ready with that character in a stronger light so that they would realize they need him on that show. And mm-hmm. so I thought that was such a great approach. But I think, like, for me, when I remember watching a show like, say, Big Love on HBO, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I would know as soon as I saw the writer's name, I would know if I was going to love the episode, because I so understood the voice of each writer and the capability mm-hmm. of each writer with the story. So there's definitely, even in mimicking somebody else's voice, like you with your spec scripts, you definitely don't want to write a spec script that doesn't feel like a produced episode. You want to write a script that feels like a produced episode, but you also want to write a script that dives and digs deep into, you know, the emotional aspect of the story or the uniqueness of the story that makes it so that yours is a script that can't be ignored. Like, I remember there was a writer on Charmed who mm-hmm. I brought him in to the executive producer, and he got staffed in the room based on the strength of his spec script. He wrote a soprano script that was so memorable. Like, I still remember it. And it was, you know, Tony, when they showed a flashback of Tony when he was a child and he got caught masturbating by his mom. and the shame that was in that moment transferred to everything that was going on in the current plot. And so he threaded it through so that everybody could connect with what that experience must have been like, which brought you so much deeper into the story. And it was a memorable script, mm-hmm. you know? And then, like, I mean, people did stuff like, I had writers write combination spec scripts. Like, there was a writer that wrote a Sopranos and a Sex in the City mixed, you know? So there certainly were different strategies that people used.
Wait a minute. Like, so hold on. That's Tony and yeah. Carrie in the same episode?
Yeah.
I'm sure he got some notice for it.
I know. And people remember this. I remember there was also a writing team who had been together for many, many years, and they wrote a pilot that that was loosely based on their split. And everyone wanted to know that story. So that became, you know, so I definitely think there are such original ways. And as I said, when you look at shows like Fleabag and The OA and Deep Poursuit, like there are ways to go outside the box with your voice, but still have a strong structure. There are also shows that that are succeeding, quite honestly, that are, the structure isn't great, but the voice is great. And mm-hmm. so, you know, so there's something to be said about this as well. That's why I think it's more important now than ever to know your voice and create concepts that really utilize the strength of your voice.
And that voice is so strong in a show like Stranger Things, which is a phenomenon at this point.
Definitely. Absolutely.
But that voice is so strong and so specific.
It is. 13 Reasons Why. I mean, so many. Like, there's just so many. Smelf, that's now up for Best Comedy. Yeah, mm-hmm. there are so many shows that people are going outside the box and they're taking risks and they're not doing traditional structure, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
But there's a freedom to do that stuff now where you couldn't do it before.
Yeah, I agree.
Look at a show like Grace and Frankie.
Yes.
Which is, I just love that show.
Yeah, I do too. It's a great show.
Such a well-written show.
It's
so funny and it's so out. Like, that would never be on network television. It just couldn't. It couldn't be.
I agree.
It was so wonderful to see them all just pounding it at, you know, the stories are just pounding at the, at a high level, as you will.
Yes.
Now, what is the biggest mistake you see first-time writers make?
I think, when it comes down to development story, I think the biggest mistake made in pilots is either too much character and not enough plot, or too much plot and not enough character. So I think it's really recognizing that, you know, TV is a character-based business. So your audience is coming back because of your characters. So so it's really doing the work on developing 2 to 3 of your characters in a very strong way that brings your audience back. And I think that many writers, you know, first they'll populate their show way too much and have way too many characters, and they'll have several characters serving the same purpose and doing the same thing. And so, you know, I think it's really understanding that less is more. And when an executive, like when I would have 300 scripts behind me during staffing season, and I opened a script, first of all, with dramas, you want to be around 58 to 60 pages max. And you don't want it to be so complex that the executive would have to read it 3 times to really be able to grasp the concept. Mm-hmm. So it's really writing toward that recognition. And I would say newer writers, you know, have the weight of, oh my God, I have to make this stand out and it has to be a dynamo. And in order to be a dynamo, so many people think they have to reinvent the wheel. And and in doing so, they like lose a grasp on what it is they're trying to say with their story.
Because they're trying to impress.
Yes.
Now with that, and on that topic, trying to impress, and this is something I've seen and I've heard from multiple places, but I'd love to hear your opinion. Sometimes when you're reading a script, especially from a new writer, you see them using not only 50 cent words, but $1.50 words that are just, you know, so out there as far as, you know, just reading. Do you feel that by doing that, you alienate the reader sometimes because, you know, it's not supposed to be a vocabulary test?
Well, you know, I know that note is definitely given. And Writers on the Verge at NBC, I'm a writing instructor there. Mm-hmm. Like, and I've done that for 9 years now. And I know that one of the notes that is often given by my colleague, Karen Horn, who runs the whole diversity program at NBC, all of the diversity programs, Karen, like, she's definitely given the note of, if I can't understand it, then you know what I mean? So you have to, yes, you have to think of those things. Like, if it's one thing, like, to go, oh, I want to use big words because I want to impress my audience. Now, it really is looking, I always say, like, you always have to think what serves the story in the strongest way.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Right.
And what, you know, but if the reader has to literally stop reading your script and go to the dictionary because they can't really place the use of the word, then there's a problem. You're interrupting the process. You're interrupting the flow. But I am a person, I have to be honest, I like a high vocabulary. Like, I am interested in people who get, and I like the lyrical and the poetic use in the language. I'm a big person of, I love when I read action lines, that they even get really creative with the action lines. Like, so that for me is, I love all that.
Now, I read in Stephen King's book On Writing, He actually brought that up. He's like, look, you know, and he's arguably one of the most successful writers in history.
Yeah,
he's like, look, I can use big words. Watch. And he just lays out this little paragraph with 45 words I've never even heard of. And he's like, did you understand that? No, that means I didn't sell that book. So stop it.
Yeah. And I could not agree more. I have to admit though, like, I don't think I've ever put a script down and said those words are too big and I can't get it. Now
you are also a very experienced reader.
I'm experienced. I've been in this for 25 years.
Yeah. So you're not the audience per se, as the general audience reading scripts today.
Yes, it's true. No, it's very true. Well, and I have to say, it's fascinating thing too, that in what people have to consider, like, you know, I have writers in my StoryWise community and they're always on a private Facebook and I always look at the comments and see what writers are talking about. And I know recently I've had several of my writers from my StoryWise 10-week teleseminar end up doing incredibly well in the competitions and the writing programs. And so they were talking about this one festival, which I'm not going to name, but they were talking about this one festival where, you know, several of them had won or placed in several competitions based on the script, their one script. And then they sent it to this festival and suddenly the feedback didn't at all align with all the other feedback that they've gotten. And that's because some of these festivals pay their readers nothing and their readers are 25 years old and they don't have the experience with story to be able to give the feedback that really, really reflects what the work is. And so when you're writing the big words and you're going over the top, you have to think about things like that. Like if you have a 25-year-old reader who misses the whole point of your story because of your vocabulary, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. And it'll never get to a person like you who can actually understand it because the gatekeepers won't let it go through.
Yeah.
So it's strategy as much as it is writing.
Yes, it is. Everything is strategy. I always say to writers, like when you're designing your writing portfolio, you have to think, what are the three top shows that I would die to write on? And then you have to look at your portfolio and go, does my portfolio support that outcome?
Fairly simple, but it's something that is missed quite often.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like the director who wants to direct action movies, but he's only done period dramas his entire life.
Yeah. And, you know, I am a believer that I see the dream happen all the time. So I'm definitely not a person who's going to say the dream doesn't happen, because the dream happens every day. Mm-hmm. And you have, I think the strongest component for the writers I've worked with that have made it in a big way is belief. You have to have belief in your talent, because if you don't believe, nobody else will.
Now, what stops screenwriters from being successful?
Getting in their own way. I mean, I see it all the time. I see it all the time. You know, you see writers who write too much and don't know how to edit back. And they talk like that as well when they're in a room. Like there is so much being said that you have to really fish out what is the main point of what is being said. So that's certainly a way. And I know that's nervous energy, and that's, and you have to go through things to really know them. But things like in other ways people get in their own way is they'll be in a room and they'll alienate other people, or they won't talk at all. So they won't contribute. So, right. So that's a problem, or they'll talk too much and you'll feel like, okay, they just want to hear themselves think, and you know, there's not valuable stuff coming out here. So I think the whole editing process on the page and in the room is the biggest part. And then I think you have incredibly talented writers who are very internal people. Mm-hmm. And to make a writing career happen, you have to be external. So that journey, you know, the perfect pilot that went into that was Silicon Valley. You know, Richard, when Ehrlich said, dude, you got to make something of Pied Piper or you're out of the house. Mm-hmm. Richard then, who was a very internal person, had to learn to become external. And in the first scene, he's pitching mm-hmm. his Pied Piper idea to these two guys at the sink at the office, and they laugh at him. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, but that's the process. Like the growth process is, yeah, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to pitch ideas that people don't like. That's okay. At least you're trying and you're learning and you're growing and you're evolving and you're moving forward. And that's what you want to be doing. You certainly don't want talent. Like, it drives me crazy when I see incredible talent mm-hmm. that may never be realized because of one thing that that gets in the way of the outcome happening.
It happens in every aspect of the of life. But in the film business, I've seen it too. Directors who get in their own way. And we've seen it publicly too sometimes.
Yes. Oh, yes, we have. I think it's a whole new world going on right now. I think, do you know, like for me though, and not to go into anything on that, which I certainly could.
Sure,
but,
of course.
But I, you know, my feeling with that is now that it's been exposed and and the careers and livelihoods and everything else have gone down the drain. And now it's like, it has to be about, the focus needs to move into changing systems mm-hmm. so that this doesn't happen. Like mm-hmm. that is more important than ever right now. I certainly mm-hmm. love that out of all this, our young daughters are going to be able to go after the dream without having to go through that. Like, that makes my heart very happy to know. Yes. I don't have kids, but like that, it's an important thing. And so I think it's a growth time for everybody in the business to really look at behavior and understand it.
Yeah, the one thing I find fascinating about it, and I've never seen this, I don't think ever, other than maybe in the McCarthy day, not McCarthy, but is it McCarthy? Yeah. Well, they were doing the communist hunt.
Yes, yes, yes.
That I don't think that's, you know, everything that's happening right now is completely valid and needed without question.
Yeah.
But I've never seen complete careers, Oscar-winning careers.
I know.
Gone.
I know.
It's gone. Kevin Spacey will not work again. I can't see a path back. Yeah. I can't see a path back.
Hollywood loves a redemption story. But
I do. That's
are people like Harvey Weinstein,
who
Kevin
he's
Spacey, Bill Cosby, that you look at, and you know, and there are other there are other big ones that I'm not even going to name.
Oh, no, but, we know. I've heard.
You know, you sit there and you go, they can't. Like, it was too dark and there were too many people saying too many things that aligned. And so you have to, but I, you know, see, stuff like this intrigues me on a psychological level because I would love to see a show done.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Where the lead character is like a Kevin Spacey or a Matt Lauer or a Harvey Weinstein, and how do they move through life after that fall?
So like, you mean, that interests me. So like a Breaking Bad, but instead of selling meth, that they're harassers.
They're redefining their life. I mean, they're having to figure out
that's a heck
where
of
they went wrong and how do they get life back on track. That intrigues me.
Because that's a curiosity too. Like after, you know, I mean, literally they wiped Kevin Spacey from this new movie that came out a few weeks before the release.
Isn't that wild?
That is, I've never.
Like you're erased. That's like
you're
crazy.
You're gone.
Yeah.
You're doing it now
like
with House of Cards.
Thing.
Now you're doing it with House of Cards and all this kind of stuff. And the funny thing is, I you know, I'm talking to my friends who, you know, are in the business, but you know, I've been around a bit longer than them. And I'm like, this guy's gonna come out next. This guy's gonna come out next. And this guy's gonna come out next.
Do you know what? I have done that too. Funny that you said that? Like, I was at dinner with a close friend of mine who had a big project with a big producer, and I said his days are numbered. And 2 days later, it was in the trades. And yes, it's so true.
It's, I mean, I was talking to my buddy the other day. I'm like, you know who's coming out next? It's gonna be Ratner's coming next.
And,
Ratner is the one. We all heard it.
I know. We all knew.
And I knew. And by the way, I heard those stories when he was in Miami pre-Rush Hour.
Yes.
Before he was a big. So I'd heard these stories.
And then I heard about Brian Singer.
Oh, I heard about
before that happened. Yeah.
Brian and Kevin, both I heard about them back in 2001.
Yeah.
I was hearing about those two.
Yeah.
That's how long ago it was.
Isn't it wild?
It's insanity.
Well, so, and the thing that's hard about this too is there's a lot of hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's certainly, you know, things have to change.
Absolutely.
Because there are a lot of people that supported this who aren't being punished.
Oh, yeah.
And who were a part of this happening. So it things have to change so that we don't have careers going down the toilet left and right every day. Like literally, it feels like a PR thing of who gets what day. When they come out.
I mean, it's insane.
So wild.
It's insane. And it's not just our business. It's now every
business. And it's all over the world. London is now heavy into it. And then Australia with Jeffrey Rush. I mean, everybody is in it now.
It's getting. It's going to get pretty, we've gone way off topic.
Yes, we have. That's all right. That's what's going on right now. That's topical.
But
do we draw from that and bring that to the page?
Without question. And that's very, very valid. Now, can you talk real quick about some bad habits you see writers do all the time?
Well, you know, there are people who will harp on typos and this and that. And I say whatever you can do, have as few typos as possible. I definitely agree that it will distract you. However, I have also seen writers who just kill themselves worry-wise after they enter a program because they find two typos. And what you have to know is if the content is there, that's what sells. So you really have to trust in the content. I would say, you know, so they, you know, things to look at, like, you know, study scripts. I mean, look at scripts, know how many pages are per act. And there's no steadfast rule on how many pages per act, but have a general idea. Like don't have a 30 page act one and then 5 pages for every other act. Like really know things that you should know through that, through looking at scripts, certainly you can go to the Writers Guild library. There are many people who say, well, I can't get a hold of scripts. Number I on my website, and I'm sure you have resources mm-hmm. as well, where you go to my resources page and my links, and I have all the websites that have scripts. And so you can get scripts. And then I would say another mistake writers make is they're not prepared for meetings. They don't know who they're meeting with. And there's no excuse mm-hmm. for this right now. Like, the internet tells you everything about everyone. And so you walk into a meeting, be prepared, be ready to, I always tell writers too, to think when you're going into a meeting, have three marketing points that you absolutely do not want to leave the meeting without sharing. Mm-hmm. Have three points. Then you could relax in the meeting, but know that you have to bring up those three points.
Now, what are those? When you mean marketing points, what do you mean exactly?
Well, anything that markets you as a writer. So say, for example, I'm not going to name him because I don't want to embarrass him, but it was actually, I love that he shared this. I had a very big showrunner at one of my seminars mm-hmm. share a story that he had gone into a meeting that was a medical show and mm-hmm. he had 13 years background as a medical administrator and he forgot to bring that up. There are things that, you get nervous and you forget. And so that's an example. Like you have to be prepared. You have to know, what is the show I'm up for? What do I have in my background that shows the executive that I have a huge well of story to be able to tell story for this concept, if you're going on a specific show. If you're not going on a specific show, then you want to know, like, what are my overall general story points? And that could, you definitely want to think about, what is a personal anecdote that I have that reveals something about me? For example, I can say for myself, when I started my own business 10 years ago, my two main story points were and are, I was in a long relationship that ended in a short marriage and represented the death of the fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And my career was interrupted mid-flow when I was a vice president because I thought I was going to run a studio. And mm-hmm. so when my contract wasn't renewed, on the heels of an unexpected situation, then I had to readjust and redefine. And mm-hmm. everything that I was a blogger for Huffington Post for like 7 or 8 years, mm-hmm. and my two books sold on those two story points. Mm-hmm. So you have to really, really, and when you share your emotional truth, that's how you discover your audience. That's how you find, when I'll go into a room and I'll say, oh, Aaron Spelling was my mentor for 12 years and I've been in the business for all this time. I've been a writing instructor for NBC for 9 years. I that. People don't connect with that because they don't know that life experience. But mm-hmm. when I say I was in a long relationship that ended in a short marriage and represented the death of the fairy tale, how many people know what it is to have your heart broken? Then you have half the room. Yeah, everyone knows. Yeah. And then I'll say, how many people have lost a job? Then you have the other half of the room raise their hand. And it's like, then it's like, I see you, you see me. And that's what you want to do.
Now, can you discuss a little bit about your books?
Yes. So Storyline Finding Gold in Your Life Story is adding fiction to your truth. So as an executive, the biggest thing I was known for was really diving deep in my writer meetings into the well of story of writers. And then I would say, have you ever written about that? And I'll say, not in an autobiographical way, but in a way of sharing your emotional truth. And the difference in the gift of sharing your emotional truth is that you can heal, and writing is healing. You can heal and bury your truth in fiction, which is why people write. And so you know, it's really, this book is all about, through breaking down features and television. And both books are based on my philosophy of story, which in simplistic terms, and I certainly go into a much more advanced look at it in my books, but in simplistic terms, my formula that I discovered, that Oscar-nominated, Emmy-nominated, Golden Globe-nominated stories, what I found when I extracted a formula was that every story starts with a powerful trigger incident that pushes the character into a dilemma.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And then the choice that is made in that dilemma is what defines the external goal. And then every action taken, obstacle hit, needs to link back to that goal. And it's when the goal isn't defined that the story doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to know what the character wants and why they want it. And so that philosophy is in every single one of us, like you talked about Michael Haig and mm-hmm. everyone out there, you know, Lee Jessup, Pilar Alexandra, mm-hmm. Dara Marks, you know, like everyone, the gift of story people really is that we are sharing what we know through our lens, through our worldview mm-hmm. of story. I happen to come from the studio executive worldview, so that's how I see story. I see story through that lens. And then after leaving that view and becoming a writing instructor for NBC and building my own business, then that lens became even more enhanced because I had the time to dig deeper into the story process and really see what it was and read every single thing out there. I mean, I highly recommend that every writer, like, read every script you can get your hands on, read every book that comes out on story, and recognize there's a value and a gift through understanding other people's worldview and understanding how to utilize it in your voice and your worldview.
That's a very good point, is understanding. And when you're following people, and because there's so many people, so many podcasts out there,
yes.
so many blogs out there.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are saying a lot of the same stuff.
Yeah.
But it's all about perspective. And I think that's one of the reasons
that's what separates you.
Right. Because, I mean, look, a lot of the information that I put out there through Indie Film Hustle is out in other places, but I have a unique perspective. And you're right. I never thought of it that way. But my worldview is coming from post-production and indie film and kind of like the trenches, if you will.
Exactly.
But not from directing a $200 million movie.
Yeah.
That's not my
there's the value in your perspective because we need to know all of it.
Correct.
You know, like I'll have people who will say, well, Jen, have you ever written a script? And I have written a script, but I'm not a writer. Mm-hmm. Like I recognize that my strength is internal with writing. So writing articles, content, and books is where my love and my passion is. Mm-hmm. And screenwriting is not my passion because I was raised on the analytical side of it. And that's the side that I love. I love diving into why story works and how to create tools to pass on to writers so that they can make their story work.
Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. So it's kind of like rapid fire.
Yes.
What advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
I think write is the probably the big, I know so many writers who don't write. So you have to have a body of work. You have to fearlessly move through every story and recognize that you grow with every script you write. So you have to, you know, really, and I think it's understanding your passion and your emotional truth. And then it's also looking at what the market, but recognizing your passion is what sells. So the market has room for new ideas. So don't think you have to write only toward the market. Mm-hmm. Know that you have to write toward your passion, because your passion is what sells.
Now, can you tell me what book had the biggest impact on your life or career?
I've had so many. That's such a good question. I mean, like on a spiritual level, there are, there's a book called Understanding the Why. I forget the name exactly of it. I would say in entertainment, in writing, my favorite books, and I have so many of them, mm-hmm. but I'd have to say I love Stealing Fire from the Gods.
Yes, great book.
I love D.B. Giles' book, The Screenwriter Within. Mm-hmm. There's a book that I'm reading right now, and I have to tell you, I have never heard of this writer, and his book is blowing me away. And mm-hmm. His name is Matt Bird, and mm-hmm. it's The Hidden Tools of Story. And the wild thing is I think it's structured toward fiction writers, not specifically television or film, but he goes so deep into television and film that I look at him and I think, all right, if there were a book if I had the time to go at the level he goes, like, that's a book that I wish I had written.
What's the name of the book again?
I'm looking it up. I think it's The Hidden Tools of Story. I'm looking it up right now.
Matt Bird. Okay, I'm going to put it in. I just want to put the link in the description.
Yeah, put the link in, because that book I have referred to people, and my clients have been blown away by, like, literally I dog-eared so many pages. It was crazy. I also love Chris Vogler. I also mm-hmm. love Michael Haig.
Sure.
You know, I am here it is. I am a huge, The Secrets of Story.
Okay.
So it's called The Secrets of Story, Innovative Tools for Perfecting Your Fiction.
Okay, great. Yeah.
So that will give you I'm a very spiritual writer. So the mm-hmm. type of authors that I'm drawn toward are people who think in the same way.
Perfect. Now, what lesson took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Probably, I do think the idea that I'm always learning is listen before you speak, like really listen. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest gift, and I do practice it every day, is really, like, I think what we tend to do, certainly in the writer's room, in meetings, and everything else, is we tend to, like, either defend or get ahead of, like, we're hearing, but we're already thinking of our answer, that we're not really listening. Mm-hmm. So I would say the thing that I am always, I feel like the greatest gift we give each other is our time and our attention. Mm-hmm. So that is something I think when I think about my arc of growth in the business, and I think of when we first start our careers, we always think, oh my God, we have to speak up. We have to say stuff. We have to make a point, and you do, but you don't want to do it just to do it. Mm. You only want to do it when you truly have something to say.
And what are three of your favorite films of all time?
I would say my very favorite film of all time is The Lives of Others, which is a German film that won won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film in 2007.
Okay.
That is definitely, and then I would say The King's Speech, mm-hmm. I think was a beyond perfect film. I there are so many that I love that it's ridiculous, but, mm-hmm. or I wish there were more. I say that there are so many. I'm talking over like a 10-year period. I wish there were more in 1 year. Mm-hmm. Birdman. I have to say, like, wonderful. Birdman, I watched, I saw Birdman 3 or 4 times. Like, for me, that was just brilliant.
When I saw that movie, I was watching the screener and I was like, oh, that's what a director does.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I forgot because I haven't seen that in so long.
Yeah.
That's what a director does.
It is. It's fascinating when you see something too. Like what I can say, like there was, I remember when I first watched The Hurt Locker and I thought, oh my God, there's something so special here, but I have to watch it again because I feel like I missed some of it. Mm-hmm. And when I watched it again, it was so impactful. Mm-hmm. To really see just where true brilliance comes from and how we feel story, you know? So, yeah.
Well, I mean, she did make one of the greatest action movies of the 90s, Point Break, obviously.
Yep, yep. Exactly. Yay for Catherine. Yes.
Where can people find you online?
They can find me very easy, jengrisanti.com. So that's very easy. My email is jen@jengrisanti.com. Also very easy. And if you Google me, you can find out everything there is to know, just like I mentioned that you should do on every person who you go to meet. Mm-hmm. I also have to recommend too, like, I don't know, are you familiar with Film Courage?
Yeah, I know them. Sure.
So it's interesting because I did an interview for Film Courage they divided it into like 10 parts. Mm-hmm. And I have so many people who say, oh my God, I learned so much through that. So that's if you want to know me and understand my philosophy, that is, that dives pretty deep into it.
Great. I'll put some of those in the show notes as well.
Yes,
Jen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to the tribe.
And congrats on your show. And I love everything you're doing. And I'm honored to be a part of it. And I love that you are getting out the word out and helping writers. I think there's nothing better.
Thank you again so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind at screenwritersmind.com.